I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Michael Levitin. He's a journalist and co-founding editor of the Occupied Wall Street Journal. He started as a reporter covering the Cochabamba water war in 2000 for the English language newspaper Bolivian Times. He earned his master's degree from the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and later worked as a freelance correspondent in Barcelona and Berlin covering politics, culture, and climate change. His writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Guardian, Financial Times, Newsweek, Time, and The Los Angeles Times, among other publications. His debut novel, Disposable Man, was published in 2019. He teaches journalism at Diablo Valley College in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he lives with his partner and daughter. And we left off the most important thing, which is you have a new book out called Generation Occupy, Reawakening American Democracy Through Counterpoint. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Great to be with you, Derek.
So sorry to be so boring, but can you introduce us to Generation Occupy, the book? And also, for those who may not remember, tell us what Occupy was and is.
Occupy Wall Street. Those are the three words that all need to flow in succession. That was the movement that ignited in the fall of 2011, 10 years ago, this autumn. It emerged in the aftermath of the financial crisis and the Great Recession to bring listeners back to that time. It was a time of great tumult. It was later Time Magazine called it the year of the protester. Occupy Wall Street was not the initial protest that year. There was the Arab Spring in January and February that dethroned dictators from Tunisia to Egypt and hundreds of thousands, millions of people marching in their streets and squares demanding democracy and real representation from governments in some of the most repressive regimes on earth, in the Middle East. And I think that coming out of the financial crisis and the Great Recession and this joblessness and inability of leaders anywhere really to address and adequately deal with the crisis, the economic and political crises facing people everywhere, crisis of representation, I think it really shocked people that this protest initially emerged in the Arab world. It quickly spread, though, to Europe, to the austerity, the anti-austerity protests seizing Spain and Greece and countries in the Mediterranean, where half the population of under 30 was out of work. And these became physical occupations where they camped in their cities and squares. It really was this global wave. It went to Wisconsin, in fact, where workers camped out and occupied the Wisconsin state capitol. That happened in the winter of 2011. But it went to Israel and Tel Aviv. It went to Chile, where students marched by the tens of thousands and shut down universities. It was all of this energy building. And then in September of 2011, it finally came to America, and Occupy Wall Street ignited in downtown Manhattan at Zuccotti Park, formerly unknown to most and now famous as the place renamed Liberty Square, where Occupy took off.
So can you move us forward a little bit through, one of the things I found interesting about Occupy was that is how many places it ended up. It was in small towns, big cities. Can you talk about its spread and just give a couple, three examples? I mean, I spoke at one by Skype or whatever in DC, and I spoke at two in person, Oakland, San Francisco. There also was one in Chico, and Chico is not a big town. So can you talk about its spread in the United States and its, how do I say this? What towns it was in, I guess?
Gosh, you want me to list the 600 or so?
No, certainly not. Yeah. Just grab a few.
The incredible...
And make sure one or two are ones that would really surprise us.
Ah, surprise us. All right. What do I have to say? Something like a Tacoma or an Occupy. All right. Well, how about Occupy Freestone, which was a little town where I believe Tom Waits lives out in Northern California, out by Occidental, about an hour and a half north of San Francisco. Little villages. I mean, that was like a one or two person occupation, but it was people holding signs and saying, I represent this movement too. The amazing thing and what was so novel and original about Occupy Wall Street. And now we've seen this echoed through the course of the decade. And that's one reason I felt compelled to tell this story. Occupy set off this new style of decentralized kind of horizontal protest that can occur in any city. And all of the cities that joined Occupy Wall Street to become Occupy DC, Occupy Boston, and quickly across the country, Occupy Denver, Occupy Chicago, Los Angeles, Seattle, and then the many smaller cities that would, you know, if you look at Oregon, I don't know, Occupy, not just Portland, but Occupy Bend, Occupy Corvallis, little towns got involved as well. It became this expression, this possibility that people who had been missing activism for so many years, you know, it kind of is important also in looking at Occupy to go back and realize that nothing like this movement had emerged in our country, and protest culture did not, frankly, kind of exist during that decade. The anti-Iraq war had sort of shut down that failure to stop the Iraq war, and the energy that went into those protests in the early 2000s. They sort of deflated what had been a really vibrant anti-globalization movement that was really charging ahead in the 90s with workers and environmentalists and people thinking that we would be able to rewire the global economy. It didn't all have to be about profits and bottom lines and shipping corporations overseas. People were pushing governments and economic leaders to address the crises that they saw with the environment, with climate change, and really with workers and communities being beaten into the ground by capitalism, by profiteering and business interests. All of those protests, economic social justice protests, sort of took a dive in the 2000s with the Iraq war. We didn't have a venue or a channel for people to voice their outrage and simply to dissent. There weren't movements to join. And once the crisis hit and the recession hit and people were out of work and once this language seized hold, it was the expression, and I hope we talk a little about that. It was the new vocabulary that Occupy introduced, that we are the 99%, the 99 versus the 1%. This language was so elemental and so clear. It wasn't new. People have been fighting class injustice and the wealthy for generations, for all time, right? It goes back to as early as civilization, I believe, where there's a few who have a lot and many who have too little. But it was the crystallization of the idea that there were these elites and they're getting the great share of the profit and the majority of people are falling further behind and it's unfair. This message caught hold. And the moment Occupy Wall Street, which was founded at the center of financial greed on Wall Street, it spread with almost instant success and popularity. It was like a viral meme. And it really was kind of one of the first viral memes. Now we have, you know, Black Lives Matter and Me Too and the global climate strikes, all these movements that seize the public's imagination. But Occupy Wall Street in this era was the first. And as we said, it sort of spread to small towns, to cities where people everywhere were able to, you know, make a sign, carry it in your march or demonstration, sit in your public square and say what you feel is wrong with this system overall. And that was sort of the participatory genius of the movement. It was open to everyone in any place and time.
So can you... you've mentioned the recession a couple times, and can you give us a little bit more detail? And you also mentioned the 1%, but I think when you said it, we both kind of presumed that everybody knows what the 1% means. Can you talk a little bit more about class differences in the United States, the sort of resentment that led to the 1%, not resentment, but the reality that led to the discussion of the 1%, and what has happened to discussions about the 1% since?
Yeah, that's getting to the heart of this story, the Occupy story, and frankly, the American story in our recent memory in this 21st century. I think that the 1%, you know, so people can take different credit for who came up with the term. I believe Joe Joseph Stiglitz finally was the one who people remember writing an essay and acknowledging what that there is a 1% of people at the top of our society who essentially, you know, are the wealthy, are the elites. It boils down to 1 in 100. What we've seen clearly in these later years is that it really boils down to 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000. It's the 0.001%. Americans, you know, America has such a love affair with capitalism. We are this culture that was founded on the ability to make wealth, to emerge from nothing. An immigrant from overseas who comes over here, and either he or she or their children have a potential to come from nothing and rise up and become wealthy, right? And become rich. And that's our founding myth. And it's our dollar chasing culture that we are sort of addicted to this dream of wealth. That kind of, I think you have to go back to the original, to the Gilded Age of the late 19th century, when the robber barons showed just how far you could play that argument out. And the J.P. Morgans and Vanderbilts and the titans of their era, banking and steel, the ones who essentially were the 1% of their period, the Gilded Age, the outrage of that time, when so few had so much and so many were struggling and had the Great Recession of the 1890s and joblessness, that led to the progressive era with Teddy Roosevelt and with the journalists, muckrakers, who came up to expose and call out this elite sliver at the top who had so much more power than the rest. That progressive era kind of continued forward. And of course, we saw great wealth expand in the early 20th century, and the 1920s were the heyday of sort of the stock market until it crashed. And then this idea of labor unions and socialists and communists and people who, you know, kind of unthinkable that it might overturn the capitalist order. But the desperation was so present in the Depression that people were finally ready to really call out the elites. And FDR was forced to act, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, with the New Deal to bail out the American people from the Depression, to give them jobs, to give them work and put a chicken in every pot, right? But to cut a long story short, to lead us to our current era, it was really the Roosevelt period of the 1930s that represented the last period in American history until Occupy, according to the many people I spoke with. It really isn't my coming up with this. I interviewed historians and analysts and so many. And many people really agree on a basic level that we hadn't had this discussion of capitalism, of naming the structures of capitalism and the elites who are sit at the top of the pyramid, the ones who govern our system and have always sort of governed it, the economic, financial, political elites, as the problem. No one had uttered it like that since the New Deal, since the Depression era, through the 40s and 50s, through America's burst out of World War II to become the economic dominant player of the planet. And then in rivalry with the Soviet Union in the middle years of the 20th century, there was no space to critique capitalism and call out and say, this is unjust and the people at the top have too much. It was a more fair society, and our taxation system actually worked a lot better in the middle years of the 20th century. But with Ronald Reagan, and the onset of deregulation, privatizations, the 1980s, shipping jobs overseas, storing excess profits in tax havens, all of this started to elevate, push the wealth higher up the economic ladder, and more people fell behind. And finally, 30, 40 years after that process got underway, we see people had enough, the financial crash, the recession, and this ability to say, you know what, the rich have been rich for too long, and they're too rich, and they're getting even richer, and we need to put some kind of a stop or a change to this system, the systematic injustice, which is what Occupy said.
Well, thank you for that. I think that's really good history. And I'm thinking about just a line that always really hits me really hard, which is that in the United States, real wages have been declining since 1973. And that I think that all fits right in with the deregulation that came in the 80s. And this, you know, it's a lot easier to get people to go along with the whole capitalist dream if there is a realistic chance that they could actually do better than their parents. And when we see that disappear, it becomes much more difficult to rationalize. I mean, yeah, it's okay if those at the top get a whole bunch, as long as I get a little bit extra, as long as I get a little taste. But if I'm not getting enough of a taste, and that's sort of, to put it cynically, and we could also put it, if my children are hungry and they have excess, if my children aren't hungry, yeah, I don't need to rock the boat. But if my children are hungry, then all bets are off.
Right. And interestingly, the Democratic Party, I think now to pivot from Ronald Reagan, who represented the epitome of the celebration of wealth and get as much as you can as an individual, and to hell with the rest of society, we're going to cut social programs and sort of pull up the ladder for those who haven't made it. To go along with that, economists I talked to, Sam Pizzagatti and Dean Baker, you know, liberal economists, folks who study inequality especially, they all remarked on the fact that Bill Clinton and the new Democrats who came in, the centrist Democrats, the triangulating ones who tried to cut deals and look as Republican as they could look while still maintaining some base among, you know, white working class voters and the rest, that was exactly that centrist Democratic argument that you just said, that it's okay that the wealthy have so much, as long as the pie gets bigger, a bit bigger for everyone. It's okay if their slice is the biggest and is growing bigger, so long as we're all getting a bit of the pie, right? But just as you said, wages stagnated after the 70s, you know, union power eroded the ability to bargain and keep your pensions and keep your health benefits. Everything got tighter and tighter, to the point where workers were not seeing their wages rise, although housing costs were rising and food costs and all the rest. And yes, that's finally, as you say, what brings people to the streets.
So this is a really unfair question. And I say this as somebody who spoke at a couple Occupies and who, you know, whose work was shared at some of them. But even still, I don't really understand what was / is Occupy. Do you see why that's an unfair question?
10 years later, it really is unfair, Derek. Because it's long gone and we're not seeing it in our faces anymore. So how can we be expected to remember it?
The reason I'm asking is because if I were to talk about the abolition movement, then I could name a few people and I could talk about specific political acts. I could talk about the American Civil War. I could talk about the conflict between abolitionism and states' rights on one level. But Occupy feels, okay, I don't agree with this assessment, but I know one person who absolutely loved Occupy because he said, it's not really a movement, it's a moment. And it was kind of sort of a hippy dippy. I mean, he was like, the thing he loved about it was that it was a moment, a happening, to use the 60s phrase,
right?
As opposed to a movement. So I get a little bit confused. And I, again, I'm not trying to say that it's hippy dippy. I'm just, which certainly ages me, I'm just asking, do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah. Yes. Why don't I jump in and help finish that sentence? Yeah, I think it is. It's hard. And that interesting abolition argument, Adam Hochschild, the great historian here at UC Berkeley, I got a chance to interview him for the book, and he precisely brought up that example of abolition, that it was easy to, you know, you could getting rid of slavery was in a sense easier than the job that Occupy set out to do, which was to abolish inequality, because slavery could be abolished with the stroke of a pen. And Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which ended slavery. You're not able to abolish inequality and to write into law something that's all of a sudden going to get rid of the vast wealth disparity in our society. It's simply not a realistic, tangible goal. The reason Occupy probably remains for so many people this kind of amorphous, sort of just cloudy memory, I'm sure for many, where, you know, I think that the majority of people, when you say Occupy, Occupy Wall Street, the one thing that springs to mind, if anything, is the 99%. Oh, yeah, it brought up the issue of inequality, didn't it? The 99%. And that really was its firm, gift, a real lasting gift to the country was precisely that language. But it was the idea. It was the reflection. I think that to simply say that it changed the language and changed the conversation, that's where it began. That was the starting point of Occupy's legacy, is that by injecting this new vocabulary, a whole new rhetorical way of describing our economic reality as Americans and really citizens of the world, who are all living under this capitalist grip, was really the true kind of gift that it gave. And that set in motion a whole new era and a way of looking at our economic condition and the fairness and the justice and the equality, and to inspire people to make demands to change it. It's as though you need to introduce the language of injustice and what is wrong before society can actually begin to address it, right? So it's true that when you say, what was Occupy or what is it? I do call it a movement. I think it was when you ignite 1,000 occupations in cities across the planet and towns and marches and demonstrations and thousands of arrests and a whole generation that is turned on and galvanized by this message. I call that a movement and a pretty successful one. It did not convert into political, into policy and all of that. But this was a reason I chose to write the book, to mention the many things that it did do. And I'd be glad to jump into that, you know, when you're ready to talk about it. But yeah, it is. It's hard for many people, I think, still to understand what exactly it left us. But yeah, that's what I set out to tell in Generation Occupy.
So yeah, let's go there in a couple minutes. I want to... Before we get there, let's do a little bit more foundation laying, which is, so can you talk about how the occupations themselves, as opposed to its ramifications, the occupations themselves, okay, so we have people in cities all over, 2 people in one city, 1,000 people in another, they're holding signs, and then move us through the time scale, the timeline until there aren't people standing with those particular, with the "We Are the 99% signs standing in Chico and Boston and Georgia or Atlanta.
Right.
So move us through that basic timeline.
Well, it's very brief. Fortunately for our program and listeners, that was a brief period. Occupy only lasted a total period, I believe. New York City was 59 days. We're talking about 2 months. It started September 17th, 2011, and Zuccotti Park was cleared of protesters on November the 15th, I believe it was, or the 15th, yes. And we're celebrating that, in fact, right now, this week. There's renewed interest because of that. And parks across the country. So essentially in those 2 months between Zuccotti Park, and then it took several weeks for, well, after Zuccotti Park, look, nobody paid attention. You want to know the timeline. The first week of the movement, the first week of its existence with young people camping out by the dozens in Zuccotti Park, the media did not want to cover it. No one looked at it. It was a motley encampment of, yes, hippie, anarchists, whatever you want to call them, college students, people, you know, it looked maybe like a homeless for financiers and people shuffling to work on Wall Street. It certainly wasn't very notable or disruptive. A week into the movement, a cop, Anthony Bologna, whose name will forever be marked for that incident, he sprayed pepper spray in the faces of several unarmed white women. The fact that they were unarmed and they were white and they were women was very important, because when people, We all in this era had just been introduced to cell phone cameras. Everybody had cell phones. We didn't previously, but they took imagery and shots of this incident, posted it to YouTube. The clips went viral. And then you've got all of a sudden a social movement ignited. The country saw this. They were forced to see on TV by the millions of views what was going on with police brutality, cracking down on unarmed protesters who are simply walking in the streets and marching with their constitutional right to protest and getting shot with pepper spray. That ignited the movement. 1 week later, 700 protesters were arrested trying to cross the Brooklyn Bridge and walk into Brooklyn from Manhattan, and police just rounded them up. That made it a global movement. That was front page of, you know, the New York Times, and it became the planet woke up and saw, wow, 2 weeks into this movement of kids camping out in one park in Manhattan, it is now a global phenomenon. And that is what ignited marches across the entire country, occupations from cities small to large. And for the next month, it was this kind of jubilant, euphoric almost, takeover of public space where, yes, people with their signs and their banners and their costumes and music, you know, instruments, it was, I wouldn't call it hippie. I mean, you could say that, but it was a new, you know, the first month at Zuccotti Park, there wasn't much marijuana or folks getting, you know, lit down there. It wasn't this thing of sitting around. It was intense, serious organizing and people staying up 24 hours a day, what felt like, to organize different meetings, to do marches, to plan actions, to coordinate with groups locally, nationwide. It was an incredible moment of like this release and really creative, capable, you know, people and really compassionate people who all sort of saw each other on a level. It didn't matter whether you came from an Ivy League school or had not gone to school, whether you were homeless or not, people came together. And it was this sense of mass participation that we weren't talking to the elites. We were talking to each other. That was the magic of it. And that lasted for quite some time. And then of course, and as my book makes clear, I'm no apologist, you know, trying to make Occupy look like some glamorous creature that was flawless. It had many faults and many flaws and full of contradictions. The leaderlessness, you know, many leaders were there, but it declared itself leaderless. It wanted to change politics, but it wouldn't become political and refused to enter the political process. It had many aspects of the chaos of sort of the general assemblies and the consensus decision making. And slowly over the course of that next month, as we moved into autumn, it, you know, disintegrated in a sense because people lost their motivation and the state police cracked down through federally coordinated FBI, Department of Homeland Security, various crackdowns that finally shut down the encampments after things had gotten out of hand and the public saw too many ragtag folks and homeless people and tents and various drug incidents and even rapes. And, you know, all it takes is a few of those to become the top news on Fox News or in the media. And suddenly you have a public that formerly more than 2/3 of Americans had in polls backed the ideas and the principles of Occupy. It had overwhelming majority support in terms of the message of inequality and tackling excess wealth and taxing the rich. But as the imagery, you know, it wasn't the message, it was the messenger that got people to kind of turn. And then people were ready, I think, for the police to somehow come in and pretty much make it disappear, which they did. So within 2 months, it was here and gone. And that is why it left this sort of like a genie, like this aura in its wake that is hard to quantify.
So before we go on to how, you know, some of the sort of the 10-year retrospective, another thing I'm thinking as you're talking is I kept thinking about like the Boston Massacre from the American Revolution and how on one level, you know, that was a spark that led to a lot of things. On another, my understanding is that the Boston Massacre started off as kind of a bunch of drunks, a bunch of drunk people basically making a mess, and the British really over. I mean, it did not start politically, is my point.
Huh.
And I could be wrong on that, and some historians certainly will write to me. But the point is, can we just throw out a few examples of how sometimes social movements have had an infancy that is that doesn't necessarily that a lot of times when social movements start, they can be confusing just in general. So I'm trying to think of really good examples of that. And I'm sure you have better ones. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Well, I do sort of. One way to maybe seg this is by saying that social movements often begin, you know, they don't achieve their ends, certainly in any quick time frame. A real social movement with depth and with long-term strength. I think it's important to see, yeah, I think you're right. The movements, I don't know about the American Revolutionary and that example, because I'm not as well read on that specific, but people coming out and camping, I'm sure it's happened in many instances where they don't intend it to blossom and sort of flourish. But it does take that initial group. You know, the night that I went to Zuccotti, and I was supposed to get on an airplane to go back to Europe. I was living in Berlin and working as a journalist. And that was why I came to New York City. I drove in. I was doing a cross-country trip and shooting a documentary. I heard on the radio about Occupy. I showed up. I had to see what it was. It was 1 week old. In fact, I arrived the day that the girls got hit by the pepper spray, the second Saturday of the movement. And I decided to stay. I couldn't drag myself away from the park. I canceled my flight and I moved into New York, moved into Zuccotti, and soon got an apartment in Sunset Park where I could better organize and be part of the newspaper and all the rest. But it was really the message of the movement had kind of transformed what was seen as possible right then. And I don't think anyone at the beginning saw where it would lead. Oh, the night I moved in, it was Michael Moore who came down, the filmmaker, who came down to the park. It was rainy. It was going to be a storm. And he told everybody there in kind of Michael Moore's, you know, unique rabble-rousing way with several hundred people around him. He said, you know, all movements start like this. They start small. A couple hundred people with the courage to come out and dissent and voice your protest. And people will remember, you know, 2 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, will remember that you came out and you started this movement. You know, no one can know when they initiate a protest. And I think it goes back to Martin Luther King, and it must go back to Gandhi, and to the FDR, to the New Deal, the union protests. These things take years of organizing to achieve real tangible results. You think that the civil rights movement, when they began their first lunch sit-in, the counter sit-ins or the bus boycott, Rosa Parks and all the rest, the people who led to Rosa Parks, you know, years prior, you can't say that they had in mind what they were going to achieve and that they were going to transform and create civil rights legislation and the Voting Rights Act and all of these achievements. Those come later. And one of the organizers I talked to for the book, great organizer who is now, alas, just died in the final months when I was putting this book together, but I had a chance to interview him, Kevin Zeese, a longtime organizer in Washington, D.C., and a former lawyer, and who started Popular Resistance, a school to train activists. His real takeaway was, you know, movements don't show their results in months or years, maybe even in decades. This, the 2020s right now that we're entering, might be the period when we actually begin to see the fruition, the results of what Occupy, the conversation that Occupy ignited and started, that these things take long time, much longer than we expect. So what activists set out to do in the beginning and what results years later is so unforeseeable. And that's maybe the magic of social movements and of human history, in a sense.
Well, thank you for giving the perfect answer to my inchoate question.
My attempt.
No, it was great. That was the answer that I was fumbling around looking for a question to elicit. So thank you. It was perfect. I want to say one more thing about that, which was Another example of that is I remember reading Noam Chomsky somewhere talking about the anti-war, protests in the United States, that on his first tour of Kansas City, he was sitting in a basement on folding chairs talking to like four people. And, you know, that was the first tour. And a year later, there might be 200. And then a year later, there was 200,000. That it takes time for all this stuff to grow. Same thing actually happened, except in a much more accelerated rate, with the French resistance in World War II. That at first, they're like when the Nazis had only been there a few months, the French were coming up with all sorts of crazy ideas that didn't work. Like one of them, and this is true, the elegance of Parisian women will cause the Germans to just stop.
And no doubt it worked its magic for a time.
and obviously they moved, and it didn't take long to move from there. But the point is, and this is true, I don't even know why I'm asking this, because the same thing is true with basketball, with anything. When you first start something, you're going to stink at it, and you get better through experience. It's just,
yeah. And absolutely. And I think that's a perfect way to say, you know, what happened to occupiers? Many people ask today, a decade later. So what, not only what happened to Occupy, the movement, and that's the opening line of my book, is people ask, what happened to Occupy? People still ask it a decade later, whatever did happen to that movement? But also, together with that, what happened to occupiers? What happened to these novice, many times for the first time in their life, stepping out and getting a taste of real political activism and organizing? Many others who had come from the anti-globalization movement, the anti-Iraq war movement, Occupy people who, as you say, started, you know, like the Chomsky example, small and not knowing where they were going or what they were doing. They went on to do incredible things. And you see over and over from the activists I interviewed for the book, how many people went from Zuccotti Park, where they were maybe 20 years old or 25, or, you know, and became part of the either leaders or connectors or people pushing the technology side or helping amplify from Black Lives Matter to the climate movement, you know, the Sunrise Movement, which is today's really maybe most vibrant expression of the youth, Gen Z, you know, climate resistance in America. That was co-founded by the man who, you know, is my, the guy who narrates that chapter in my book, Evan Weber, who came out of, he was a college junior when he went down to Occupy Wall Street and helped lead the very first day's march at Occupy as a 20-year-old. And then look what he does. He sort of moves his way through the environmental resistance, the direct action movements, and the Washington, D.C. crowd, and finally gets aligned with other Occupy organizers who are creating groups to help build strategic movement planning organizations, much more organized than Occupy was, much more directed with a blueprint for change. And he ends up uniting with other people to create the Sunrise Movement, which becomes our climate movement. There were these direct ties between Occupy as young people just cutting their teeth on real in the streets, direct action activism, and these more tactical and strategic movements that have actually driven change and given us things like the Green New Deal and these other kind of larger ideas and movements from Black Lives Matter, Standing Rock. Many people went from movement to movement and helped elevate. And that's sort of part of the whole generation idea that I try to tackle in the book, is that it created this, it gave birth to this new culture of protest. And the people who were at Zuccotti and at Occupy parks around the country, they didn't just go home and say, fold up shop and say, well, shoot, that movement didn't work. They became the people who spirited and helped organize the new era of resistance that I think we see all around us. Look at the March for Our Lives, a bunch of teenagers in Parkland, Florida, using many of the same methods developed at Occupy. By the decentralized organizing, the technology, the spreading via social media, these movements all capitalized. And you can look at the Women's March even, and the resistance to Trump, and the immigrant rights movement in the era of Trump. So many reflect, you know, what Occupy kind of the ways that Occupy showed that protest can happen.
Well, that's a really great response. So we have about 5 minutes left, and you know, you really anticipated the next question, which is, what are the effects of, what are the ripples moving forward through social change and through modern history of Occupy? And you've said what happened to the occupiers. Do you want to talk about any more of the ramifications and the importance of Occupy? And also, can you talk a little bit about the role of the 99% / 1%? How do we, does it seem to you that that's been dropped a little bit, or does it need to be revivified, or do you think that it's just as strong as ever?
My goodness, thanks. That's a great, great intro to the question. I think, frankly, myself, and I admit I'm maybe an optimist, might be going too far, but I am hopeful because I see these trends continuing. I've been following them for 10 years since Occupy. I've been observing. I think that the economic argument has only grown more powerful and convincing to a wider number of people, frankly. I think that what Occupy did, and this adds to the legacy question, previous, your main one, besides the social movements, and I think we didn't even address two of the major achievements that Occupy actually spurred. One is in the world of labor and workers. Occupy struck up this idea of the 99% that workers have to look out for themselves and their interests. Your bosses aren't going to do it. They're going to cut your wages and your pensions and your health care and all the rest. You need to organize. Unions had been crushed from the Reagan years, from the 80s after the air traffic controller strike of 1981, where Reagan fired about 11,000 workers overnight and said, that's it. Your era has come to an end. This is the period of private, of capital and big finance, not the workers' era. They went quiet for decades. Union membership was just at an all-time low, and it remains very low. But what Occupy did was it started this spirit of defiance and of defense of their own economic rights, where the year after Occupy closed, the closure of the camp in November 2012, the fight for a $15 minimum wage began in Manhattan, organized in part by Occupy Wall Street veterans who got together with community leaders and church leaders and nonprofits and got the first several hundred, as we go back to those numbers of only a couple hundred people, the first several hundred fast food workers in the city from Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's and all the rest who walked off their jobs in a simple act of declaration that they want a $15 minimum wage. That was an unheard of demand, right? $15 an hour back in 2011 seemed off the wall. Guess what? Within months, that movement bloomed into a nationwide following where people in cities across the country, first several dozen cities, then 60, then 200 cities, and a global movement emerged fighting for a $15 wage and for better wages for our lowest paid workers. That increased wages, people put on the ballots in more than 30 states in the next years after Occupy to raise wages. It forced the public, and it was popular in every state where there was a popular an amendment or a proposition or elected officials who were, you know, advocating it. It was approved, and wages were raised across the nation. And we're having this debate in Washington now, whether to raise the federal minimum, thanks to Bernie Sanders, who I want to get into in one instant. But on the workers' front, you know, the fight for 15 led also to the Walmart worker strikes, Black Friday strikes. Occupy people had a hand in those as well. Those were a major kind of a signal to the richest family on earth, the Waltons, who run Walmart, that their workers were restive and they needed higher wages to survive. And they got a wage increase at the world's largest retailer because of those protests. And we had the nationwide teacher strikes within the red states, Oklahoma, West Virginia, Arizona, these places that you didn't expect, right-to-work states with right-to-work laws, where teachers, regular working class, middle class teachers, women mostly organizing them, went out and demanded raises, and they got them. And now where are we today in the coronavirus period? We're in the Great Resignation, aren't we? So if you want to draw a line from a disempowered worker class to a more empowered I will make choices, and I have agency over my life, whether to stay in this job where my health is jeopardized because an employer wants me to work during a pandemic with no, you know, no face coverings, et cetera, like so many fast food workers and others, and at our meat processing plants, et cetera, to now today where people, it's as though the scales have really started to shift. I can't say that inequality is taken care of or that the power balance has shifted immensely, but it's begun. And people, I think that that's the clear trend from Occupy, is that our workers have awoken to their own power. And I would just end by saying that that Occupy changed our politics profoundly. People don't want to acknowledge that maybe in the mainstream, but everyone I talked to for this book recognized very forthrightly that without Occupy, you would not have had Bernie Sanders and his 2016 run for presidency. He was a Vermont Democratic socialist shouting into the wilderness about injustice and the billionaires for decades, but no one was ready to hear his message of economic injustice and of inequality and corporate greed and taxing the rich until Occupy laid that front and center, created the language, prepared the ground, and Bernie rode that as a skilled politician right on into a presidential primary that he nearly beat Hillary Clinton and came right up close and did it again in 2020. He changed our politics. He changed the Democratic Party. He brought Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez right into the fold to represent the new generation of anti-corporate Democrats, unlike the Obama and Clinton style Democrats. Elizabeth Warren was part of this process. These folks who say rein in the banking power. And redistribute wealth and change our taxation system. All these conversations that are now a part of this reconciliation package and how much wealth to redistribute and deliver to the American people and working families, that's what's being argued right now in Washington. And my argument would be that those progressive priorities that are front and center now of the Democratic Party were not there. Those were fringe, those were far left priorities that are now mainstream. And thanks to Bernie and Warren and the Democrats who are more progressive, but that they owe their thanks in part to Occupy for changing the language and allowing their message to resonate. So that's sort of my parting sense, is that we have real political possibilities that have opened up because of Occupy. And now the question is, where do we go from here and how do we build on that to really bring those priorities into a reality?
Well, thank you so much for that. And I have one more question before we're done, which is, how can people get your book and how can people find out more about your work in general?
Go to a bookstore, support your local independent bookstore. It's called Generation Occupy, Reawakening American Democracy. You can get it online if you're an Amazon person. It's at Barnes & Noble if you live near a shopping center, but you can basically order it at any place. It's published with Counterpoint Press here in Berkeley. And my website is michaellevitin.com, Levitin. So feel free to please write me up. I love hearing from people who have comments and reflections and suggestions and anything to do with these issues. Because as you can tell, Derek, I'm rather obsessed about many of them. I've been thinking about them for some time. I love communicating about it. And thank you for the rich conversation today.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Michael Levitin. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.